This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Lilac Girls by Martha Hall Kelly. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell, Kathleen Gotti, and Catherine Khanna. With a note read by the author. Part 1. Chapter 1. Caroline. September 1939. If I'd known I was about to meet the man who'd shatter me like bone china on terracotta, I would have slept in. Instead, I roused our florist, Mr. Sitwell, from his bed to make a boutonniere. My first consulate gala was no time to stand on ceremony. I joined the riptide of the great unwashed moving up Fifth Avenue. Men in gray felted fedoras pushed by me, the morning papers in their attachés bearing the last benign headlines of the decade. There was no storm gathering in the east that day, no portent of things to come. The only ominous sign from the direction of Europe was the scent of slack water wafting off the East River. As I neared our building at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 49th Street, I felt Roger watching from the window above. He'd fired people for a lot less than being 20 minutes late. But the one time of year the New York elite opened their wallets and pretended they cared about France was no time for skimpy boutonnières. I turned at the corner, the morning sun alive in the gold-leaf letters chiseled in the cornerstone, La Maison Française. The French building, home to the French consulate, stood side by side with the British Empire building, facing Fifth Avenue, part of Rockefeller Center, Junior Rockefeller's new complex of granite and limestone. Many foreign consulates kept offices there then, resulting in a great stew of international diplomacy.
"All the way to the back and face the front," said Cuddy, our elevator operator.
Mr. Rockefeller hand-picked the elevator boys, screening for manners and good looks. Cuddy was heavy on the looks. Though his hair was already salt-and-peppered, his body in a hurry to age. Cuddy fixed his gaze on the illuminated numbers above the doors.
"You got a crowd up there today, Miss Faraday. Pia said there's 2 new boats in."
"Delightful," I said. Cuddy brushed something off the sleeve of his navy blue uniform jacket.
"Another late one tonight?"
For the fastest elevators in the world, ours still took forever. "I'll be gone by 5. Gala tonight." I loved my job. Grandmother Woolsey had started the work tradition in our family, nursing soldiers on the battlefield at Gettysburg. But my volunteer post as head of family assistance for the French consulate wasn't work, really. Loving all things French was simply genetic for me. My father may have been half-Irish, but his heart belonged to France. Plus, Mother had inherited an apartment in Paris, where we spent every August, so I felt at home there. The elevator stopped. Even through the closed doors, we could hear a terrific din of raised voices. A shiver ran through me.
"Third floor," Cuddy called out. "French consulate, watch your—"
Once the doors parted, the noise overpowered all polite speech. The hallway outside our reception area was packed so tightly with people one could scarcely step through. Both the Normandy and the Île-de-France, 2 of France's premier ocean liners, had landed that morning in New York Harbor, packed with wealthy passengers fleeing the uncertainty in France. Once the all-clear horn signaled and they were free to disembark, the ship's elite streamed to the consulate to iron out visa problems and other sticky issues. I squeezed into the smoky reception area, past ladies in Paris's newest day dresses who stood gossiping in a lovely cloud of arpège, the sea spray still in their hair. The people in this group were accustomed to being shadowed by a butler with a crystal ashtray and a champagne flute. Bellboys in scarlet jackets from the Normandy went toe-to-toe with their black-jacketed counterparts from the Île-de-France. I wedged one shoulder through the crowd, toward our secretary's desk at the back of the room, and my chiffon scarf snagged on the clasp of one ravishing creature's pearls. As I worked to extract it, the intercom buzzed unanswered. Roger. I pressed on through, felt a pat on my behind, and turned to see a midshipman flash a placky smile. Gardons nos mains pour nous-mêmes, I said. Let's keep our hands to ourselves. The boy raised his arm above the crowd and dangled his Normandy stateroom key. At least he wasn't the over-60 type I usually attracted. I made it to our secretary's desk, where she sat, head down, typing. Bonjour, Pia. Roger's cousin, a slow-eyed boy of 18, was sitting on Pia's desk, legs crossed. He held his cigarette in the air as he picked through a box of chocolates, Pia's favorite breakfast. My inbox on her desk was already stacked with case folders.
Vraiment? What is so good about it?
She said, not lifting her head. Pia was much more than a secretary. We all wore many hats, and hers included signing in new clients and establishing a folder for each, typing up Roger's considerable correspondence, and deciphering the massive flood of daily Morse code pulses that was the lifeblood of our office. Why is it so hot in here? I said. The phone is ringing, Pia. She plucked a chocolate from the box.
It keeps doing that.
Pia attracted Beau as if she emitted a frequency only males could detect. She was attractive in a feral way, but I suspected her popularity was due in part to her tight sweaters. Can you take some of my cases today, Pia?
Roger says I can't leave this chair.
She broke the shell of the chocolate's underside with her manicured thumb, stalking the strawberry cremes.
Yosso wants to see you right away, but I think the woman on the sofa slept in the hallway last night.
Pia flapped one half of a $100 bill at me.
And the fatty with the dogs says he'll give you the other half if you take him first.
She nodded toward the well-fed older couple near my office door, each holding a brace of gray-muzzled dachshunds. Like Pia's, my job description was wide-ranging. It included attending to the needs of French citizens here in New York, often families fallen on hard times, and overseeing my French Families Fund, a charity effort through which I sent comfort boxes to French orphans overseas. I'd just retired from an almost two-decade-long stint on Broadway, and this felt easy by comparison. It certainly involved less unpacking of trunks. My boss, Roger Fortier, appeared in his office doorway.
Caroline, I need you now. Bonnet's canceled.
You can't be serious, Roger. The news came like a punch. I'd secured the French foreign minister as our gala keynote speaker months before.
It's not easy being the French foreign minister right now.
He called over his shoulder as he went back inside. I stepped into my office and flipped through the wheel decks on my desk. Was Mother's Buddhist monk friend a John Shafri that night?
Caroline!
Roger called. I grabbed my wheel decks and hurried to his office, avoiding the couple with the dachshunds, who were trying their best to look tragic.
Why were you late this morning?
Roger asked.
Pia's been here for 2 hours already.
As Consul General, Roger Fortier ruled from the corner suite with its commanding view of Rockefeller Plaza and the Promenade Café. Normally, the famous skating rink occupied that sunken spot, but the rink was closed for the summer, the space now filled with café tables and tuxedoed waiters rushing about with aprons to their ankles. Beyond, Paul Manship's massive golden Prometheus fell to earth, holding his stolen fire aloft. Behind it, the RCA building shot up 70 floors into the sapphire sky. Roger had a lot in common with the imposing male figure of wisdom chiseled above the building's entrance. The furrowed brow, the beard, the angry eyes.
I stopped for Bonnet's boutonniere.
Oh, that's worth keeping half of France waiting.
Roger bit into a donut, and powdered sugar cascaded down his beard. Despite what might kindly be called a husky figure, he was never at a loss for female companions. His desk was heaped with folders, security documents, and dossiers on missing French citizens. According to the French consulate handbook, his job was to assist French nationals in New York in the event of theft, serious illness, or arrest, and with issues related to birth certificates, adoption, and lost or stolen documents, to plan visits of French officials and fellow diplomats, and to assist with political difficulties and natural disasters. The troubles in Europe provided plenty of work for us in all those categories, if you counted Hitler as a natural disaster. I have cases to get back to, Roger. He sent a manila folder skidding across the polished conference table.
Not only do we have no speaker, I was up half the night rewriting Bonnet's speech, had to sidestep Roosevelt letting France buy American planes.
France should be able to buy all the planes they want.
We're raising money here, Caroline. It's not a time to annoy the isolationists, especially the rich ones.
They don't support France anyway.
We don't need any more bad press. Is the U.S. too cozy with France? Will that push Germany and Russia closer? I can barely finish a third course without being interrupted by a reporter. And we can't mention the Rockefellers. Don't want another call from Junior. Guess that'll happen anyway now that Bonnet canceled.
It's a disaster, Roger.
May need to scrap the old thing.
Roger raked his long fingers through his hair, digging fresh trenches through the Brill cream.
Refund? $40,000? What about the French Families Fund? I'm already operating on fumes. Plus, we've paid for 10 pounds of Waldorf salad.
They call that salad?
Roger flipped through his contact cards, half of them illegible and littered with crossouts.
It's pathetique. Just chopped apples and celery, and those soggy walnuts.
I scoured my wheel decks in search of celebrity candidates. Mother and I knew Julia Marlowe, the famous actress, but she was touring Europe.
How about Peter Patou? Mother's people have used him.
The architect?
Of the whole world's fair. They have that 7-foot robot.
Boring,
he said, slapping his silver letter opener against his palm. I flipped to the L's.
How about Captain Lahoud?
Of the Normandy. Are you serious? He's paid to be dull.
You can't just discount every suggestion out of hand, Roger. How about Paul Rodier? Betty says everyone's talking about him.
Roger pursed his lips, always a good sign.
The actor? I saw his show. He's good. Tall and attractive, if you go for that look. Fast metabolism, of course.
At least we know he can memorize a script.
He's a bit of a loose cannon, and married too, so don't get any ideas.
I'm through with man, Roger, I said. At 37, I'd resigned myself to singledom.
Not sure Rodier will do it. See who you can get, but make sure they stick to the script. No Roosevelt.
No Rockefellers, I finished. Between cases, I called around to various last-minute possibilities, ending up with one option, Paul Rodier. He was in New York appearing in an American musical review at the Broadhurst Theater, The Streets of Paris, Carmen Miranda's cyclonic Broadway debut. I phoned the William Morris agency and was told they'd check and call me back. 10 minutes later, Monsieur Rodier's agent told me the theater was dark that night and that though his client did not own evening clothes, he was deeply honored by our request to host the gala that evening. He'd meet me at the Waldorf to discuss details. Our apartment on East 50th Street was a stone's throw from the Waldorf, so I rushed there to change into Mother's black Chanel dress. I found Monsieur Rodier seated at a café table in the Waldorf's Peacock Alley bar, adjacent to the lobby, as the two-ton bronze clock sounded its lovely Westminster Cathedral chime on the half-hour. Gala guests in their finest filtered in, headed for the grand ballroom upstairs. "Monsieur Rodier," I said. Roger was right about the attractive part. The first thing a person noticed about Paul Rodier, after the initial jolt of his physical beauty, was the remarkable smile. "How can I thank you for doing this so last minute, monsieur?" He unfolded himself from his chair, presenting a build better suited to rowing crew on the Charles than playing Broadway. He attempted to kiss my cheek, but I extended my hand to him, and he shook it. It was nice to meet a man my height.
"My pleasure," he said.
His attire was the issue, green trousers and aubergine velvet sports jacket, brown suede shoes, and worst of all, a black shirt. Only priests and fascists wore black shirts. And gangsters, of course. "Do you want to change?" I resisted the urge to tidy his hair, which was long enough to pull back with a rubber band. "Shave, perhaps?" According to his agent, Monsieur Rodier was a guest at the hotel, so his razor sat just a few stories overhead.
"This is what I wear," he said with a shrug.
Typical actor. Why hadn't I known better? The parade of guests en route to the ballroom was growing, the women stunning in their finery, every man in tails and patent leather Oxfords or calf opera pumps. "This is my first gala," I said. "The consulate's one night to raise money. It's white tie." Would he fit into father's old tux? The inseam would be right, but it would be much too tight in the shoulders.
"Are you always this, well, energized, Miss Faraday?"
"Well, here in New York, individuality is not always appreciated." I handed him the stapled sheets. "I'm sure you're eager to see the script." He handed it back.
"Non, merci."
I pushed it back into his hands, but the Consul General himself wrote it.
"Tell me again why I'm doing this."
"It's to benefit displaced French citizens all year and my French family's fund. We help orphans back in France whose parents have been lost for any number of reasons. With all the uncertainty abroad, we're one reliable source of clothes and food. Plus, the Rockefellers will be there tonight." He paged through the speech.
"They could write a check and avoid this whole thing."
"They're among our kindest donors, but please don't refer to them. Or President Roosevelt. Or the planes the U.S. sold France. Some of our guests tonight love France, of course, but would rather stay out of a war for now. Roger wants to avoid controversy."
"Dancing around things never feels authentic. The audience feels that."
"Can you just stick to the script, monsieur?"
"Worrying can lead to heart failure, Miss Faraday."
I pulled the pin from the Lily of the Valley. "Here, a boutonniere for the guest of honor."
"Muguet?"
Monsieur Rodier said.
"Where did you find that this time of year?"
"You can get anything in New York. Our florist forces it from Pips." I rested my palm against his lapel and dug the pin deep into the French velvet. Was that lovely fragrance from him or the flowers? Why didn't American men smell like this, of tuberose and wood musk and...
"You know Lily of the Valley is poisonous, right?"
Monsieur Rodier said. "So don't eat it. At least not until you've finished speaking. Or if the crowd turns on you." He laughed, causing me to step back. Such a genuine laugh. Something rarely found in polite society, especially where my jokes were concerned.
I escorted Monsieur Rodière backstage and stood awed by the enormity of the stage, twice the size of any I'd stood upon on Broadway. We looked out over the ballroom to the sea of tables lit by candlelight, like flowery ships in the darkness. Though dimmed, the Waterford crystal chandelier and its six satellites shimmered. "This stage is enormous," I said. "Can you carry it?"
Monsieur Rodière turned to me. "I do this for a living, Miss Faraday."
Fearing I'd only antagonize him further, I left Monsieur Rodière and the script backstage, trying to dismiss my brown suede shoe fixation. I hurried to the ballroom to see if Pia had executed my seating chart, more detailed and dangerous than a Luftwaffe flight plan. I saw she'd simply tossed several cards onto the six Rockefeller tables, so I rearranged them and took my place close to the stage between the kitchen and the head table. Three stories of red-draped boxes rose up around the vast room, each with its own dinner table. All 1,700 seats would be filled. A lot of unhappy people if all didn't go well. The guests assembled and took their seats. An ocean of white ties, old mine diamonds, and enough Rue de Faubourg Saint-Honoré gowns to clean out most of Paris's best shops. The girdles alone would ensure both Bergdorf and Goodman reached their third-quarter sales goals. A row of journalists collected alongside me, pulling their pencils out from behind their ears. The head waiter stood poised at my elbow, awaiting the cue to serve. Elsa Maxwell entered the room, gossip monger, professional party hostess, and self-promoter ne plus ultra. Would she remove her gloves to write terrible things about this night in her column, or just memorize the horror of it all? The tables were almost full when Mrs. Cornelius Vanderbilt, known to Roger as Her Grace, arrived, her four-story Cartier diamond necklace ablaze at her chest. I gave the signal to serve as Mrs. Vanderbilt's bottom made contact with her seat cushion, her white fox stole, complete with head and feet, draped over her chair back. The lights dimmed, and Roger lumbered to the spotlighted podium to heartfelt applause. I'd never been this nervous when I was the one on stage.
Mesdames et messieurs, Foreign Minister Bonnet sends his sincerest apologies, but he cannot be here tonight.
The crowd buzzed, not sure how to react to disappointment. Did one ask for one's money refunded by mail? Call Washington? Roger held up one hand.
But we have convinced another Frenchman to speak tonight. Though not appointed to a government role, he is a man cast in one of the best roles on Broadway.
The guests whispered to one another. There is nothing like a surprise, provided it's a good one.
Please allow me to welcome Monsieur Paul Rodière.
Monsieur Rodière bypassed the podium and headed for center stage. What was he doing? The spotlight cast around the stage for a few moments, trying to locate him. Roger took his seat at the head table next to Mrs. Vanderbilt. I stood nearby, but outside of strangling range.
"It's my great pleasure to be here tonight," Monsieur Rodière said, once the spotlight found him. "I am terribly sorry Monsieur Bonnet could not make it."
Even sans microphone, Monsieur Rodière's voice filled the room. He practically glowed in the spotlight.
"I am a poor replacement for such a distinguished guest. I hope it wasn't trouble with his plane. I'm sure President Roosevelt will be happy to send him a new one if it was."
A swell of nervous laughter rolled around the room. I didn't have to look at the journalists to know they were scribbling. Roger, skilled in the art of the tête-à-tête, managed to speak with Mrs. Vanderbilt and send daggers my way at the same time.
"True, I cannot talk to you about politics,"
Monsieur Rodière continued.
"Thank God,"
someone shouted from a back table. The crowd laughed again,
louder this time.
But I can talk to you about the America I know, a place that surprises me every day, a place where open-minded people embrace not only French theater and books and cinema and fashion, but French people as well, despite our faults.
Shit, said the reporter next to me to his broken pencil. I handed him mine.
Every day I see people help others. Americans inspired by Mrs. Roosevelt, who reaches her hand across the Atlantic to help French children. Americans like Miss Caroline Faraday, who works every day to help French families here in America and keeps French orphans clothed.
Roger and Mrs. Vanderbilt looked my way. The spotlight found me, standing at the wall, and the familiar light blinded me. Her Grace clapped, and the crowd followed. I waved until the light, mercifully quickly, whipped back to the stage, leaving me in cool darkness. I didn't miss the Broadway stage, really, but it was good to feel the warmth of the spotlight on my skin again.
This is in America, not afraid to sell planes to the people who stood beside them in the trenches of the Great War. In America, not afraid to help keep Hitler from the streets of Paris. In America, not afraid of standing shoulder to shoulder again with us if that terrible time does come.
I watched, only able to look away for a few peeks at the crowd. They were engrossed, and certainly not focused on his shoes. Half an hour passed in an instant, and I held my breath as Monsieur Rodière took his bow. The applause started small, but rose in waves like a tremendous rainstorm pelting the roof. A teary-eyed Elsa Maxwell used a hotel napkin to dry her eyes, and by the time the audience rose to their feet and belted out La Marseillaise, I was glad Bonnet didn't have to follow that performance. Even the staff sang, hands over their hearts. As the lights came up, Roger looked relieved and greeted the crush of well-wishers that lingered near the head table. When the evening wound down, he left for the Rainbow Room with a gaggle of our best donors and a few Rockettes, the only women in New York who made me look short. Monsieur Rodière touched my shoulder as we left the dining room.
I know a place over on the Hudson with great wine.
I need to get home, I said. Though I hadn't eaten a thing, warm bread and buttery escargot came to mind, but it was never smart to be seen out alone with a married man. Not tonight, monsieur, but thank you. I could be home in minutes. To a cold apartment and the leftover Waldorf salad.
You'll make me eat alone after our triumph,
Monsieur Rodière said. Why not go? My set ate at only certain restaurants, which you could count on one hand, all within a 4-block radius of the Waldorf, nowhere near the Hudson. What harm could one dinner do? We took a cab to Le Grenier, a lovely bistro on the west side. The French ocean liners sailed up the Hudson River and docked at 51st Street. So some of New York's best little places popped up near there, like Chanterelle after a good rain. Le Grenier lived in the shadow of the SS Normandy, in the attic of a former harbor master's building. When we exited the cab, the great ship rose high above us, deck bright with spotlights, 4 floors of portholes aglow. A welder at her bow sent apricot sparks into the night sky as deckhands lowered a spotlight down her side to painters on a scaffold. She made me feel small standing there, below that great black prow, her 3 red smokestacks, each bigger than any of the warehouse buildings that extended down the pier. Salt hung in the end of summer air as Atlantic seawater met Hudson River fresh. The tables at Le Grenier were packed with a nice enough-looking crowd, mostly middle-class types, including a reporter from the gala, and what looked like ocean liner passengers happy to be on terra firma. We chose a tight, shellacked wooden booth, built like something from the inside of a ship, where every inch counts,
Le Grenier's maître d'hôtel, Monsieur Bernard, fawned over Monsieur Rodière, told him he'd seen the streets of Paris 3 times, and shared in great detail the specifics of his own Hoboken community theater career. Monsieur Bernard turned to me.
And you, mademoiselle? Haven't I seen you on the stage with Miss Helen Hayes?
An actress,
Monsieur Rodière said with a smile. At close range, that smile was unsafe. I had to keep my wits about me, since Frenchmen were my Achilles heel. In fact, if Achilles had been French, I probably would have carried him around until his tendon healed. Monsieur Bernard continued.
I thought the reviews were unfair.
We'll order, I said.
One used the word stiffish, I believe.
We'll have the escargot, monsieur. Light on the cream, please.
And what was it the Times said about Twelfth Night? Miss Faraday sufficed as Olivia? Harsh, I thought.
And no garlic. Undercook them, please, so they are not too tough.
Would you like them to crawl to the table, mademoiselle?
Monsieur Bernard scratched down our order and headed for the kitchen. Monsieur Rodière studied the champagne list, lingering over the details.
An actress, eh? I'd never have guessed.
There was something appealing about his unkempt look, like a potager in need of weeding. The consulate suits me better. Mother's known Roger for years, and when he suggested I help him, I couldn't resist. Monsieur Bernard placed a basket of bread on our table, lingering a moment to gaze at Monsieur Rodière, as if memorizing him.
"Hope I'm not running off a boyfriend tonight,"
Paul said. He reached for the bread basket as I did, and my hand brushed his, warm and soft. I darted my hand back to my lap. I'm too busy for all that. You know New York. Parties and all. Exhausting, really.
Never see you at Sardi's.
He pulled apart the loaf, steam rising to the light. Oh, I work a lot.
I have a feeling you don't work for the money.
It's an unsalaried position, if that's what you mean. But that's not a question asked in polite society, monsieur.
Can we dispense with the monsieur? Makes me feel ancient.
First names? We've only just met.
It's 1939.
Manhattan society is like a solar system with its own order. A single woman dining with a married man is enough to throw planets out of alignment.
No one will see us here,
Paul said, pointing out a champagne on the list to Monsieur Bernard. Tell that to Miss Evelyn Shimmerhorn over there in the back booth.
Are you ruined?
He said with a certain type of kindness seldom found in achingly beautiful men. Maybe the black shirt was a good choice for him after all. Evelyn won't talk. She is having a child, poorly timed, dear thing.
Children. They complicate everything, don't they? No place for that in an actor's life.
Another selfish actor.
How does your father earn your place in this solar system?
Paul was asking a lot of questions for a new acquaintance. Earned, actually. He was in dry goods.
Where?
Monsieur Bernard slid a silver bucket with handles like gypsy's earrings onto the table, the emerald green throat of the champagne bottle lounging against one side. Partnered with James Harper Poor.
Of Poor Brothers? Been to his house in East Hampton. He's not exactly poor. Do you visit France often?
Paris every year. Mother inherited an apartment on Rue Chauveau-Lagarde. Monsieur Bernard eased the cork from the champagne with a satisfying sound, more thud than pop. He tipped the golden liquid into my glass, and the bubbles rose to the rim, almost overflowed, then settled at the perfect level. An expert pour.
My wife, Rina, has a little shop near there called Les Jolies Choses. Have you seen it?
I sipped my champagne, the bubbles teasing my lips. Paul slid her picture from his wallet. Rena was younger than I had imagined, and wore her dark hair in a China doll haircut. She was smiling, eyes open wide, as if sharing some delicious little secret. Rena was precious, and perhaps my complete opposite. I imagined Rena's to be the type of chic little place that helped women put themselves together in that famous French way. Nothing too coordinated, with just the right amount of wrong. "No, I don't know it," I said. I handed the picture back. "She's lovely, though." I finished the champagne in my glass. Paul shrugged.
"Too young for me, of course, but..."
He looked at the photo a few moments, as if seeing it for the first time, head tilted to one side, before slipping it back into his wallet.
"We don't see much of each other."
I fluttered at the thought, and then settled, weighted by the realization that even if Paul were available, my forceful nature would root out and extinguish any spark of romance. The radio in the kitchen blared scratchy Edith Piaf. Paul lifted the bottle from the bucket and tipped more champagne into my glass. It effervesced, riotous bubbles tumbling over the glass's edge. I glanced at him. We both knew what that meant, of course. The tradition. Anyone who's spent any time at all in France knows it. Had he overpoured on purpose? Without hesitation, Paul tapped his finger to the spilled champagne along the base of my glass, reached across to me, and dabbed the cool liquid behind my left ear. I almost jumped at his touch, then waited as he brushed my hair aside and touched behind my right ear, his finger lingering there a moment. He then anointed himself behind each ear, smiling. Why did I suddenly feel warm all over? "Does Rena ever visit?" I asked. I tried to rub a tea stain off my hand, only to find it was an age spot.
Delightful. "Not yet. She has no interest in theater. Hasn't even come over here to see the streets of Paris yet. But I don't know if I can stay. Hitler has everyone on edge back home."
Somewhere in the kitchen, two men argued. Where was our escargot? Had they sent to Perpignan for the snails? "At least France has the Maginot Line," I said.
"The Maginot Line, please. A concrete wall and some observation posts? That's only a gauntlet slap to Hitler."
"It's 15 miles wide."
"Nothing will deter Hitler if he wants something," Paul said.
There was a full-blown ruckus in the kitchen. No wonder our entree had not arrived. The cook, mercurial artiste, no doubt, was having a fit about something. Monsieur Bernard emerged from the kitchen. The portholed kitchen door swung closed behind him, flapped open and shut a few times, and then stood still. He walked to the center of the dining room. Had he been crying?
"Excusez-moi, ladies and gentlemen."
Someone tapped the glass with a spoon, and the room quieted.
"I have just heard from a reliable source."
Monsieur Bernard took a breath, his chest expanding like leather fireplace bellows.
"We have it on good authority that..."
He paused, overcome for a moment, then went on.
"Adolf Hitler has invaded Poland."
"My God," Paul said. We stared at each other as the room erupted with excited exchanges, a racket of speculation and dread. The reporter from the gala stood, tossed some crumpled dollars on the table, grabbed his fedora, and bounded out. In the hubbub that followed his announcement, Monsieur Bernard's final words were almost lost.
"May God help us all."
Chapter 2. Kasia. 1939. It really was Pietrik Bakowski's idea to go up to the bluff at Deer Meadow to see the refugees. Just want to set straight the record. Matka never did believe me about that. Hitler had declared war on Poland on September 1st, but his soldiers took their time getting to Lublin. I was glad, for I didn't want anything to change. Lublin was perfect as it was. We heard radio addresses from Berlin about new rules, and some bombs fell on the outskirts of town, but nothing else. The Germans concentrated on Warsaw, and as troops closed in there, refugees by the thousands fled down to us in Lublin. Families came in droves, traveling southeast 100 miles, and slept in the potato fields below town. Before the war, nothing exciting ever happened in Lublin, so we appreciated a good sunrise sometimes more than a picture at the cinema. We'd reached the summit overlooking the meadow on the morning of September 8th, just before dawn, and could make out thousands of people below us in the fields, dreaming in the dark. I lay between my two best friends, Nadia Vatroba and Pietrik Bakowski, watching it all from a flattened bowl of straw, still warm, where a mother deer had slept with her fawns. The deer were gone by then, early risers. This they had in common with Hitler. As dawn suddenly breached the horizon, the breath caught in my throat, the kind of gasp that can surprise you when you see something so beautiful it hurts, such as a baby, anything, or fresh cream running over oatmeal, or Pietrik Bakowski's profile in dawn's first light. His profile, 98% perfect, was especially nice, drenched in dawn, like something off a 10 zloty coin. At that moment, Pietrik looked the way all boys do upon waking, before they've washed up. His hair, the color of fresh butter, matted on the side where he'd slept. Nadia's profile was also almost perfect, as was to be expected of a girl with her delicate features. The only thing holding her back from 100% was the purple bruise on her forehead, a souvenir from the incident at school. Less of a goose egg now, but still there. She was wearing the cashmere sweater she let me pet whenever I wished, the color of unripe cantaloupe. It was hard to understand how such a sad situation could lead to the prettiest scene. The refugees had fashioned a most elaborate tent city out of bed linens and blankets. As the sun rose, like an X-ray, it allowed us to see through the flowered sheets of one tent to the shadows of people inside, dressing to meet the day. A mother in city clothes flapped open her sheet door and crept out, holding the hand of a child dressed in pajamas and felt boots. They poked the ground with sticks, digging for potatoes. Lublin rose beyond them in the distance, like a fairy tale city, scattered with old red-roofed pastel buildings as if a giant had shaken them in a cup and tossed them on the rolling hills. Farther west was where our little airport and a complex of factories once sat, but the Nazis had already bombed that. It was the first thing they hit, but at least no Germans had marched into town yet. "Do you think the British will help us?" Nadia said. "The French?" Pietrik scanned the horizon.
"Maybe."
He ripped grass from the ground and flung it in the air.
"Good day for flying. They better hurry."
A string of spotted cows sashayed down the hill toward the tents to graze, bells tanging, led by kerchiefed milkwomen. One cow lifted her tail and scattered a troop of lumps behind her, which those following stepped around. Each woman carried a tall silver milk can against one shoulder. I squinted to find our school, St. Monica's Catholic School for Girls, a tangerine flag swaying from its bell tower. It was a place with floors so polished we wore satin slippers inside. A place of rigorous lessons, daily mass, and strict teachers. Not that any of them had helped Nadia when she needed it most, except for Mrs. Mikelski, Our favorite math teacher, of course. Look, Nadia said. The women are coming with the cows, but no sheep. The sheep are always out by now. Nadia noticed things. Though only 2 months older than me, already 17, she seemed more mature somehow. Pietrik looked past me at Nadia as if seeing her for the first time. All the boys liked her, with her perfect cartwheel, flawless Maureen O'Sullivan complexion, and thick blonde braid. Maybe I was not as beautiful and a miserable athlete, but I was once voted best legs and best dancer in my gymnasium class in an informal poll. A first. At our school, anyway. You notice everything, Nadia, Pietrik said. Nadia smiled at him. Not really. Maybe we should go down there and help dig potatoes. You're good with a shovel, Pietrik. She was flirting with him? A direct violation of my number one rule. Girlfriends first! Pietrik pulled my wreath from the river on Midsummer Eve, gave me a silver cross necklace. Did traditions mean nothing anymore? Maybe Pietrik was falling for her? It made sense. Earlier that month, the girl guides had been selling dances with local boys for charity, and Pietrik's little sister Luisa told me, Nadia bought all 10 of Pietrik's dances. Then there was that awful dust-up outside the school gates. Nadia and I were leaving school when street boys started throwing rocks at Nadia and calling her names because her grandfather was Jewish. Pietrik had been so quick to rescue her. People throwing rocks at Jews was not something unusual to see, but it was unusual for it to happen to Nadia. I'd never known she was part Jewish before that. We attended Catholic school, and she'd memorized more prayers than I had. But everyone knew once our German teacher, Herr Speck, made us chart our ancestors and told the whole class. I'd tried to pull Nadia away that day as the boys hurled rocks, but she'd stood firm. Mrs. Michalski, pregnant with her first child, had rushed out, wrapped her arms around Nadia, and shouted at the bullies to stop or she'd call the police. Mrs. Michalski was every girl's favorite teacher, our North Star, since we all wanted to be like her, beautiful and smart and funny. She defended her girls like a mother lion and gave us krovki, toffee candies, for perfect math tests, which I never failed to get. Pietrik, who'd come to walk us home, chased the street boys away, waving a shovel in the air, but ended up with a little chip off his front tooth, which in no way damaged his smile, and in fact, only made it sweeter. I was startled from my daydream by a peculiar sound, like the buzz of crickets all around us. It grew louder until the vibration soaked the ground beneath us. Planes. They zoomed over us, flying so low they turned the grass inside out, light bouncing off their silver bellies. 3 abreast, they banked right, leaving an oily smell in their wake, and headed for the city, their gray shadows gliding across the fields below. I counted 12 altogether. They looked like the planes from King Kong, I said. Those were biplanes, Kasia, Pietrik said. Curtis hell divers. These are German dive bombers.
Maybe they're Polish.
They're not Polish. You can tell by the white crosses under the wings.
Do they have bombs? Nadia asked, more intrigued than afraid. She was never afraid.
They already got the airport, Pietrik said. What else can they bomb? We have no ammunition depot.
The planes circled the city and then flew west, one behind the other. The first dove with a terrible screech and dropped a bomb in the middle of town, right where Karkovskie Przedmieście, our main street, wound by the town's finest buildings. Pietrik stood.
Jesu Christe! No!
A great thud shook the ground, and black and gray plumes rose from where the bomb had fallen. The planes circled the city again, and this time dropped their bombs near Crown Court, our town hall. My sister Susanna, a brand new doctor, volunteered at the clinic there some days. What about my mother? Please, God, take me directly to heaven if anything happens to my mother, I thought. Was Papa at the postal center? The planes carouseled around the city and then flew toward us. We dove to the grass as they passed over us again, Pietrik on top of Nadia and me, so close I felt his heart beating through his shirt against my back. Two planes circled back as if they'd forgotten something. "We need to," Pietrik began. But before we could move, both planes dove and flew closer to the ground, across the field below. In an instant, we heard their guns firing. They shot at the milkwoman. Some of the bullets hit the field and sent puffs of dust up, but others hit the women, sending them to the ground, their milk spilling onto the grass. A cow cried out as she fell, and the pop, pop, pop of bullets punched through the metal milk cans. The refugees in the fields dropped their potatoes and scattered, but bullets found some as they ran. I ducked as the last two planes flew back over us, leaving the field below strewn with bodies of men and women and cows. The cows that could still run bucked about as if half mad. I tore down the hill, Nadia and Pietrik behind me, through the forest along pine-needled paths toward home. Were my parents hurt? Susanna? With only two ambulances, she'd be at work all night. We slowed at the potato field, for it was impossible not to stare. I walked the milk can's length away from a woman Susanna's age, potatoes scattered around her. She lay on her back across whole rows of dirt, left hand across her chest, shoulder steeped in blood, face splattered with it too. A girl knelt next to her. "Sister," the girl said, taking her hand, "you need to get up." "Compress the wound with two hands," I told her, but she just looked at me. A woman wearing a chenille robe came and knelt near them. She pulled a length of amber rubber from her black doctor's bag. Nadia pulled me away. "Come, the planes might come back." In the city, people were running everywhere, crying and yelling to one another, evacuating by bicycle, horse, truck, cart, and on foot. As we neared my street, Pietrik took Nadia's hand.
"You're almost home, Kasia. I'll take Nadia."
"What about me?" I called after them. But they were already off, down the cobblestones toward Nadia's mother's apartment. Pietrik had made his choice. I headed for the tunnel, which ran under the ancient Krakow gate, a soaring brick tower with a bell-shaped spire, my favorite Lublin landmark, once the only entrance to the whole city. The bombs had cracked the tower down the side, but it was still standing. My math teacher, Mrs. Mikelski, and her husband, who lived close to me, cycled past, headed in the opposite direction. A very pregnant Mrs. Mikelski turned as she rode.
"Your mother is frantic looking for you, Kasia," she said.
"Where are you going?" I called after them.
"To my sister's," Mr. Mikelski shouted back. "Get home to your mother," Mrs. Mikelski shouted over her shoulder.
They cycled on, disappeared into the crowd, and I continued toward home.
"Please, God, let Matka be unhurt."
Once I arrived at our block, every cell in my body tingled with relief to see that our pink sliver of a building still stood. The house across the street had not been so lucky. It was razed to rubble, now just a mess of concrete, plaster walls, and twisted iron beds strewn across our road. I scrambled over the wreckage, and as I drew closer, saw one of Matka's curtains blow gently out the window in the breeze. That's when I realized every one of our windows had been blown out by the bombs, blackout paper and all. There was no need to fetch the apartment key from behind the loose brick, for the door was wide open. I found Matka and Susanna in the kitchen near Matka's drawing table, gathering fallen paintbrushes scattered about the floor, the smell of spilled turpentine in the air. Pshina, our pet chicken, followed behind them. Thank heaven Pshina was not hurt, for she was more like our family dog than a hen. "Where have you been?" Matka said, her face white as the drawing paper in her hand. "Up at the meadow," I said. "It was Pietrik's I..." Susanna stood, holding a pile of glass shards in a cup, her white doctor's coat, gray with ash. It had taken her 6 long years to earn that coat. Her suitcase stood next to the door. No doubt she'd been packing to go live at the hospital for her pediatric residency when the bombs had dropped.
"How could you be so stupid?" Susanna said.
"Where's Papa?" I said as the two came and brushed bits of concrete from my hair. "He went out," Matka began.
Susanna grabbed Matka's shoulders. "Tell her, Matka."
"He went looking for you," Matka said, about to dissolve into tears.
"He's probably at the postal center," Susanna said. "I'll go find him."
"Don't go," I said. "What if the planes come again?" An electric eel of fear punctured my chest. Those poor women lying in the field.
"I'm going," Susanna said. "I'll be back."
"Let me come too," I said. "They'll need me at the clinic."
"Why do you do such stupid things? Papa's gone because of you."
Susanna slipped her sweater on and stepped toward the door.
"They don't need you at the clinic. All you do is roll bandages anyway. Stay here."
"Don't go," Matka said. But Susanna rushed out, always strong, like Papa. Matka went to the window and bent to pick up shards of glass, but gave up because her hands were shaking so badly, and came back to me. She smoothed my hair, kissed my forehead, and then held me tight, saying, "Yachikoham," over and over like a skipping record. "I love you." Matka and I slept in her bed that night, both with one eye open, waiting for Papa and Susanna to walk in. Pshina, more dog than fowl, slept at the foot of our bed, her head tucked beneath one downy wing. She woke with a squawk when Papa did come home, well before dawn. He stood in the bedroom doorway, his tweed jacket powdered with ash. Papa always had a sad face, like that of a bloodhound. Even in his baby pictures, those creases and folds of skin hung down. But that night, the light from the kitchen cast a shadow on his face, making him look sadder still. Matka sat up in bed. "Adi?" She threw back the blanket and ran to him, their silhouettes dark against the light from the kitchen. "Where's Susanna?"
"I haven't seen her," Papa said. "When I couldn't find Kasia, I went to the postal center and took my files outside to burn. Information the Germans will want. Names and addresses. Military lists. They've occupied the postal center in Warsaw and cut the telegraph line. So we're next."
"What happened to the staff?" Matka said. Papa glanced in my direction and did not answer.
"Our best guess is German troops will be here in a week. Chances are they'll come here first."
"Here?" Matka gathered her housecoat around her neck.
"Looking for me. I may be useful to them." Papa smiled, but his eyes stayed dark. "They'll want to use the postal center for their communications."
No one knew the postal center like Papa. He'd run it for as long as I could remember. Did he know secrets? Papa was a patriot. He'd rather die than tell them anything. "How do they even know where we live?" Papa looked at Matka as if she were a child.
"They've been planning this for years, Halina. If they take me, hopefully they'll need me enough to keep me alive. Give it 2 days. If you don't hear from me, take the girls and go south."
"The British will help us," Matka said. "The French. No one is coming, my love. The mayor is evacuating, taking the police and fire brigade. For now, we need to hide what we can.
Papa pulled Micah's jewelry box from the dresser and talked